Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, January 23, 2020. The murder of Hala Kassano trial set for February 10th. His statements stand. Accused's plea rejected by judge. A Champaign County jury will be allowed to hear what Michael Henslick told Champaign County Sheriff's investigators about his alleged role in the rape and murder of his former high school classmate and mobile home park neighbor. Exactly how much the jury hears of his 5.5-hour interaction with police on August 28, 2018 remains to be determined as attorneys slog through pretrial motions in an attempt to refine their respective cases. Henslick is set to be tried by a jury before Judge Heidi Ladd on February 10th for the first-degree murder of Hala Kassano, 22. The single working mother was discovered on November 2, 2009 by her mother, repeatedly stabbed to death in her own home on DuPage Street in the Candlewood Estates Mobile Home Park in Mahomet. Authorities later determined she had also been sexually assaulted. Despite an intensive ongoing investigation by Champaign County Sheriff's detectives, the killer went undetected for 9 years, until a relatively new investigative technique using the combination of DNA and genealogy led police to Henslick. His defense team, First Assistant Public Defender Lindsay Yankus and Assistant Public Defender Andrea Bergstrom, had sought to keep his statement from the jury, arguing that he had not voluntarily given it. In a 3-hour hearing Wednesday, State's Attorney Julia Reitz and First Assistant State's Attorney Troy Lazar sought to prove otherwise by having the men involved in Henslick's arrest and subsequent interrogation on August 28, 2018, testify about the circumstances surrounding both. Lazar stepped in at the 11th hour to assist Reitz after their colleague, Assistant State's Attorney Matt Bonnock, broke his ankle over the weekend. Bonnock had done the majority of the state's preparation for the suppression hearing, but Lazar handled the questioning of the witnesses Wednesday. Ladd came down on the side of the state, finding that nothing that happened during the lengthy interview smacked of pressure, coercion, or trickery by the seasoned detectives. "It was a cordial exchange, a knowing waiver," she said. Both the prosecutors and the defense attorneys had earlier agreed that Ladd should watch the videotaped statement prior to the hearing for the sake of judicial economy. On Wednesday, Sheriff's Captain Shane Cook testified that he made the initial contact with Henslick at Marketplace Mall about 6:15 p.m. on that Tuesday, explaining to him that he was arrested for violating a no contact order with his girlfriend, an alleged victim of domestic violence, at Henslick's hands in April 2018. Cook said they made small talk while waiting outside the mall for Deputy Robert Hubbard to arrive in a regular squad car to drive Henslick to the sheriff's office. Detectives, no threats. Although told he was arrested in connection with a domestic violence case, Henslick was about to be questioned as a suspect in the Kassano murder, the probable cause for which came together only days before his arrest. Hubbard described Henslick as perfectly fine when he got in the car. "He was wondering about what was going on, and I told him I didn't know much," Hubbard testified, adding there was no force, threat, or coercion by him to get Henslick to say anything. Once at the Main Street Sheriff's Office, Sergeant Chris Darr, one of the detectives who had worked the murder investigation for several years, met Henslick at Hubbard's squad car, then walked the handcuffed suspect to an 8x10 interview room where he would remain for the next several hours with the exception of a bathroom break. There, Detectives David Sherrick and Dwayne Rolfs began questioning Henslick after Sherrick read Henslick his Miranda rights, which Henslick said he understood. He was given water, was allowed to smoke, and was never left alone in the room. The detectives described how they sought to build a rapport with Henslick and maintained that they never threatened, touched, or coerced him. He was fairly stoic. After 90 minutes, Sherrick said he decided to leave the room and let Darr come in. "I felt we weren't getting anywhere with me asking the questions. Sergeant Darr is a good interviewer," Sherrick said. Darr and Rolfs then continued on, making little headway until about 10:30 p.m., some 3 hours and 45 minutes into the interview, when Rolfs said he decided to change my approach. Of particular concern to Yankus was Rolfs raising his voice and dropping a portfolio from about a foot above the table on the table, which made a loud noise in the body camera recording the interview. I didn't see a whole lot of reaction, Rolfe said of Hensley's response to his more aggressive stance. He's leaning back in his chair with a cigarette in his hand. He was fairly stoic. I'm pleading with him to be open to share with us details of what happened that night, he said, adding that he asked Henslick a series of direct, intentional questions if he had killed her. Now, do big boy things. After a few moments, Henslick responded, I'm sorry. On cross-examination by Yankus, Rolfs admitted he told Henslick that his denials were wearing on me. He also admitted telling Henslick, you're a big boy, you're a 30-year-old man, now do big boy things, stand up and be a man. I'm sick of sitting here listening to a bunch of bull coming out of your mouth. Lazar argued that Rolfe's raising his voice and dropping a notebook on a table were absolutely insignificant when you look at it in comparison to everything else, and that Henslick was still clearly in control of his decision to talk to police. Yankus disagreed, saying Henslick was boxed in by the detectives, and that after Henslick said, I'm sorry, and Rolfs continued to yell at him, that his will was overcome. He was going to say whatever it took to get that person out of his face, Yankus argued. We have Jim Dye's column. Legal maneuvering keeps wheels spinning. It ain't over till it's over. So said famed New York Yankees catcher Yogi Berra about the outcome of sporting events. But he may well have been talking about litigation because it too can go on and on without certainty as to who ultimately will emerge triumphant when and if it ever ends. That point was driven home by a recent First District Appellate Court decision that revived a lawsuit involving a 1982 double murder in Chicago. That's 38 years ago and the legal ramifications continue. It's been the subject of numerous articles in this space, and some of the actors include one-time death row inmate Anthony Porter, accused murderer Al Story Simon, former Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez, Northwestern University Journalism Professor David Protas, and assorted lawyers and journalists. This case stems from one of the most famous murder cases in the recent history of our state. The background of the case is gripping. It is no real surprise that the events surrounding the case have spurred a movement, a book, and other media attention. But that media attention is the reason the parties are before the court today, wrote Appellate Justice John Griffin in a recent decision that revived a defamation lawsuit filed by one of the actors in this drama. In June 2018, this story appeared to be over. That's when Northwestern reached a settlement with Simon, who accused Protas of framing him for two murders he did not commit so as to free the man who actually was responsible, Porter, from prison. Lawyers Terry Eckel and James Sotis worked for years to free Simon. Then they pursued a civil case against Northwestern and Protas for several years more, seeking financial redress from Simon. When Northwestern finally did settle the case, it insisted that details of their legal deal with Simon remain top secret. Now Eckel, Sotos, and Simon are targets of a defamation lawsuit filed by Paul Cialino, an investigator Protas hired to work with him on the Porter-Simon story. Other defendants include Alvarez, former Chicago Tribune reporter Bill Crawford, and Whole Truth Films. A trial court dismissed Cialino's case on the grounds that he failed to file it within the statute of limitations. The appellate court reinstated much of it. It ruled that Cialino's lawyers filed it within proper time frame, with one exception, Alvarez. The allegedly defamatory statements attributed to defendants are found in a book and the movie it inspired, Griffin wrote in his opinion. The book was written by Crawford, who he relied on numerous official documents. The movie quoted Eckel and Sotos about what they found in their investigation on Simon's behalf. For those who don't recall, Porter was charged with 1982 murders of a Chicago couple, Jerry Hillard and Marilyn Green. He later was convicted and sentenced to death, once coming within hours of execution before he won a court-ordered delay. Eventually, Porter's case came to the attention of Protas, who had won a nationwide reputation for reinvestigating murder cases with his students. The storyline, journalism professor and his students free the innocent, was irresistible to the news media. Ultimately, Protas, working with Cialino, identified Simon as a potential suspect and confronted him. They told him they had evidence that he had killed the couple, showed him a video they made with an actor posing as a witness, and identifying Simon as the killer, and convinced him he was about to be arrested by Chicago police. In the end, Simon served 15 years in prison before his conviction was reversed and he was freed. But Cialino, unhappy with how he was publicly portrayed, filed the defamation claims. This case is a long way from a trial on the merits, although the appellate court reversed the trial court's decision to dismiss. There will be considerably more pretrial skirmishing before it will be subject, if it ever is, to a trial on the merits. In the meantime, time and legal bills run onward and upward. Talk of the town, Homer. Heads up, Homer residents, don't discard the envelopes that contains your next water bill until you see what else is inside. In it should also be a note with a sort of news not often delivered in Illinois. Your taxes are going down. The savings stem from a move the village board made just before the holidays to pay off the remaining balance on the former Church of Christ building and the approximately 8 acres surrounding it that Homer purchased for $680,000 in 2007 and turned into Village Hall. To make the finances work, the village took out a 20-year USDA loan, adding a 3% surcharge on utility taxes to cover it. After 12 years of paying ahead, Cunningham says the debt was gone, and soon so will be the taxes. The utility tax portion has already been removed from the bills. The telecommunications portion should be removed by the state no later than July. All told, estimates the mayor of the town of 1,168. It should amount to a monthly savings of between $18 to $25 per home or household. Says Cunningham, the board felt that we had an obligation to the taxpayers to remove the tax because it was specifically designated to pay for the building, and with the building paid, the tax was no longer needed. Champaign County Treasurer, Judge nixes Bombanek's write-in request. A Champaign County judge has ruled against a bid to include a write-in election for county treasurer on the March 17th Republican primary ballot. Judge Jason Bohm ruled Wednesday in favor of the Champaign County Clerk's Office in a complaint for administrative review and motion for a temporary restraining order filed January 17th by John Bombanek, who was seeking to mount a write-in campaign as a Republican for county treasurer. Bombanek, 42, of Champaign, filed a declaration to run as a write-in candidate for treasurer in the primary late last week, but it was rejected by County Clerk Aaron Ammons based on state election code requirements and the timing of Treasurer Laurel Pressing's resignation after December 2, 2019. Pressing's resignation will be effective January 31st, and she will be replaced temporarily with an appointee who will be approved by the county board. Both Republican and Democrats slate a candidate for to run in the November 3rd general election. Had Bombanek been successful in being able to run as a write-in candidate in the primary and gotten enough votes, he would have advanced to the general election as the Republican nominee. Barbara Mann, Chief of Civil Division of the Champaign County State's Attorney's Office, said there are other ways for Bombanek to run for treasurer in November. He can be a write-in candidate in that election, or he can ask to be the slated GOP candidate, she said. Those alternate paths protect his rights and the voters' rights to choice, she said. Crime update. Champaign man facing 23 years for drug offense. A Champaign man who was shot as he left his home to sell drugs faces up to 23 years in prison when he is sentenced in March. Timothy Davis, 26, who lives in an address in the 1500 block of Kingsway and the 1100 block of North McKinley Avenue, pleaded guilty Wednesday before Judge Tom DeFontis to possession with intent to deliver cocaine, a Class X felony. The charge stemmed from drug activity Davis engaged in at a home in the 700 block of West John Street, Champaign, on November 14, 2018. On that day, Assistant State's Attorney Christopher McCallum said Davis was leaving the John Street address when would-be robbers shot him, hitting him 3 times. Davis went back in the house and left with another person before the police arrived. He declined to tell police anything about the shooters. In the house, police found multiple 1-ounce bags of cocaine, at least one of which had Davis's fingerprints on it, McCallum said. Police also found a handgun under a bed and ammunition in a closet. The prosecutor said police searched the car that co-defendant LaWanda Moore, Davis's girlfriend, used to drive him to the hospital and found another 3 ounces of cocaine, 2 guns, and about $6,900 cash. Moore, 29, pleaded guilty last summer to aggravated unlawful use of weapons for having a loaded, uncased gun on the floorboard of the car she used to drive Davis to the hospital. She was sentenced to 30 months of probation. Although Davis is eligible for up to 30 years in prison for the Class X charge, McCallum agreed to limit his recommendation to 23 years. McCallum also agreed to dismiss several other counts in the case, to which Davis' plea and two other separate cocaine and weapons cases from 2019. We have some sports. Illini men's basketball. DeSumo doing it all for Illini. Guard now displaying skills as a playmaker. Ayo DeSumo can be tagged with several appropriate labels. The 6'5", 185-pound Illinois guard is a scorer. DeSumo became the first true freshman to lead the Illini in scoring last season, and he's on pace to make it two in a row as a sophomore, unless he's usurped by freshman center Kofi Coburn. Part of DeSumo's abilities as a scorer came in another spot-on label, that of the fast break demon. He's often times at his best, pushing the ball up the court, looking to get to the rim. Closer fits too. DeSumo has made clutch shot after clutch shot during number 21 Illinois' five-game winning streak, finishing off Wisconsin, Rutgers, and Northwestern, and extinguishing any hope Purdue had down the stretch Tuesday night at Mackey Arena. The Boilermakers saw the latest evolution in DeSumo's game in person. The next mantle he's assumed, playmaker. It's one thing that DeSumo is averaging 17.2 points on shooting, 51% from the field, 33% from the three-point range, and 94% from the free throw line during the last four games. But to do that while also averaging 6.2 assists in that span has taken his complete game to another level. My game has evolved, DeSumo said. I like to make the right play each and every time, whether it's getting an assist or shooting. What's helped DeSumo grow as a playmaker for his teammates as much as himself is the way Illinois handles point guard duties. The ball might not be in DeSumo's hands immediately. Trent Frazier provides the initial thrust. But the Illini offense is structured to get DeSumo just as many opportunities with the ball as off it. We're doing a better job of putting him in the right places, Illinois coach Brad Underwood said of DeSumo. Trent at the point, that's relieved a lot of stress from Mayo. It's put him in position where he's not having to necessarily play with the ball. He's got movement before it, triple threat before it. DeSumo set a new career high with 11 assists during Illinois' 79-62 win at Purdue on Tuesday. It was also his first career double-double, and Underwood was quick to point out that 11 assists were helped by DeSumo's teammates making their shots at 55.1% clip for the game. Still, DeSumo put his teammates in position to succeed. When I have the ball in pick and rolls, it's just natural for me to make the right play, DeSumo said. I'm not forcing anything. I take what the defense gives me, whether that's throwing a lob to Kofi, throwing it back to Trent for a three, or skipping it to Georgie. I like making the right play every time. Coburn has benefited as much as any Illini from DeSumo's growth as a playmaker. The two have developed an effective dynamic in ball screen action, and Illinois opened the second half Tuesday with a powerful alley-oop dunk by Coburn from DeSumo. Underwood joked Coburn owed DeSumo dinner for helping facilitate his 22.9. I love Io to death, Coburn said. Our relationship off the court is really good, and I think that translates over to basketball. Me trusting him and him trusting me. Whenever I come off the screen, he's going to throw it as high as possible, and I have to go get it. DeSumo reads his ball screen action with Coburn like a quarterback does the secondary. How does the help defense react to the screen determines the play DeSumo will make. He might have other open teammates, but a hard rim run by Coburn is always an option. I throw that ball high, DeSumo said. Nobody else can get to it but him. DeSumo has that trust in his teammates. It's reciprocated whether the Chicago native is acting as playmaker, scorer, or closer. Like Tuesday when Purdue had pulled within 9 points with less than 5 minutes to play, and DeSumo pulled up for a pair of mid-range jumpers. Run back on defense, Colbert said, is the first thing he thinks when DeSumo takes shots like that down the stretch. Literally, I'm not even kidding. Run back on defense. At halftime, he was like, yo, I've got to make those shots. I'm like, yo, Io, we know what you can do, man. I know that you've called upon when you're going to come through. DeSumo has repeatedly And it's one of the reasons Illinois will make a five-game winning streak into Saturday's game at Michigan with a chance to win six straight Big Ten games for the first time since the 2004-05 season. Griffin apologizes for situation at Purdue. Sophomore guard addresses ejection. Illinois guard Alan Griffin apologized in person to Sasha Stefanovic after he stepped on the Purdue guard's chest during the first half of Tuesday night's game at Mackey Arena in West Lafayette, Indiana. Griffin followed up with a full statement early Wednesday evening, less than 24 hours after the 21st-ranked Illini ended up defeating Purdue 79-62. I sincerely apologize for my actions towards Sasha Stefanovic during Tuesday night's game, Griffin's note he posted to social media began. What happened was out of character and does not reflect who I am as a person. Sasha was kind enough to allow me to meet him after the game to offer my apologies. To Sasha, coach Matt Painter, the rest of the Purdue team, my coaches and teammates, and Illini Nation, I am deeply sorry that this incident caused a distraction in what was otherwise a great night for our team. I promised to coach Brad Underwood that my teammates that I would be more mindful in the future. Griffin was ejected with 12 minutes, 18 seconds to play in the first half of Tuesday night's game. Illinois was able to withstand a Purdue run after the ejection, with momentum flipping in the Boilermakers' favor and turning a one-point halftime deficit into a 17-point road win. We don't condone any of that, Underwood said about Griffin's actions after the game. That's not a part of anything we're trying to do in our program. Comets and Blue Devils win to set up four straight meeting and title game. Oakwood girls basketball is back in familiar territory. The Comets guaranteed as much with a 37-19 victory against Hoopston area on Wednesday night in their final pool play game at the Vermilion County Tournament. Oakwood, winners of the past three county showcases, advanced to Friday's 8 p.m. championship game against Bismarck-Henning-Rossville-Alvin at David S. Palmer Arena. But the Comets didn't have an easy time of it against the Cornjerkers. Oakwood found it difficult early to score the ball and get looks for senior Caitlin Young in the post. The Comets, 19-5, only led 6-4 throughout the opening 8 minutes after missing their first six attempts from the field. Neither team, in fact, scored until Ashlyn Pinnix made two-pointer for Oakwood happened midway through the first quarter. The Comets, however, found a better offensive rhythm in the second quarter, mostly through effective ball movement to free up opportunities for Pinnick, Young, and Aliyah Demias. That allowed Oakwood to stretch its advantage to 23-11 at the break, with a trio of Denius, Pinnick, and Young accounting for 18 of the Comets' first-half points. A big part of our offense is just moving without the ball, and sometimes when teams do a good job of denying Caitlin the ball, we all just stand and watch, Oakwood coach Stephanie Marsh said. I feel like I was constantly on the girls during the timeout saying, you have to move without the ball. The rest of you are going to have to step up and be confident with the ball. The other players did their role, and they stepped up when we needed them to. Hoopston area, 11-11, cut its deficit to 27-17 with 1:59 to go in the third quarter, and Addison Jones jump shot. But that was as close as the Cornjerkers got. A block from Young secured a 12-point advantage for the Comets entering the fourth quarter, and the Murray State women's basketball signee scored six consecutive points to begin the final period. The first half I knew I wasn't making a lot of shots, so I tried to get it to my teammates and work hard on defense to make up for that, Young said. Those shots for me started falling in the second half. Young finished with a game-high 16 points, while Denius and Pinnick added 6 points apiece. Lexi Breimeyer led Hoopston area with 9 points, and the Cornjerkers will play Salt Fork in Friday's third-place game at 6:30 p.m. That was our game plan. Let them beat us outside and stop them inside, and we'll live with that if they beat us outside, Hoopston coach Aaron Fell said. Honestly, the last two times we've played them, we've played great defense on them. We just didn't score. The Cornjerkers' inability to find consistent offense meant the Comets are one win from a fourth consecutive county championship, a fact not lost on Young. I've been to the championship all 4 years, so I wanted to go for my last year, said Young, whose Oakwood outfit has beaten BHRA in the last three title games. It's super special to at least be in the championship game. It would be super special to win it again. Bismarck-Henning-Rossville-Alvin 50, Salt Fork 42. Not much could stop Emily Meidel on Wednesday night, not even a sprained ankle after the Blue Devils senior landed on a Salt Fork player's foot early in the first quarter. Meidel poured in a game-high 31 points against BHRA, 20-5, stave off an upset attempt in an overtime win. She drained the go-ahead three-pointer to begin the extra period and effectively put the game away in the final minute by completing a three-point play following a Salt Fork foul. They had all of the momentum going into the overtime, but our kids really stepped up on the defensive end and started knocking stuff loose, Blue Devils coach Mike Stevens said. Emily's injury early really threw everyone off. There were some definite concerns on our side. She showed just what kind of heart she has. The Storm, 13-11, rallied late in regulation with Jaden Baum and Carson Todd knocking down three-pointers in the final minute. Todd's made three, tied the game at 40. Kaylee Davis finished with 15 points to pace the Salt Fork. Westville 40, Georgetown Ridge Farm 9. Hadley Cox scored 13 points to lead the Tigers 5-19 past the Buffaloes on Wednesday night and into Friday's 5 p.m. fifth-place game against Armstrong Potomac 4-15. Briley Cullum scored 5 points to lead GRF 0-17. Consensus, help wanted. As count looms, 1,000-plus jobs to fill in Champaign County. If you'd like a temporary job paying $20.50 an hour and you're willing to talk to people on their doorsteps, has Uncle Sam got a deal for you? Hundreds of census takers are still needed in Champaign County and others in the area, and the jobs come with paid training and flexible hours across days, nights, and weekends, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. The application process is being handled online. Lower unemployment is making it somewhat more challenging to hire enough census takers compared to a decade ago, according to Janine Beasley, media coordinator for the Regional Census Bureau office in Chicago. These jobs are good opportunities for college students, those who worked the 2010 census, anyone with a flexible schedule, and teachers who are off during the summer, she said. The work done by census takers runs from mid-May through July 31st, Beasley said. The public will start receiving invitations and instructions on how to take part in the census starting in mid-March, and census takers will be sent to the homes of people who don't respond by late April. How many census takers will be needed in each county won't be determined until after people have an opportunity to answer the census questions on their own. More than 1,000 people are still needed to apply for census jobs in Champaign County, according to Beasley. The Census Bureau has a goal of recruiting 1,928 people in Champaign County to fill in census taker hiring pool, and as of Wednesday was 43% of the way there, she said. Hundreds of additional census takers are still needed to apply for census taker jobs in Vermilion, Piatt, Douglas, and Ford County, she said. Census takers will be paid $20.50 an hour in all those counties except for Douglas County, where the pay rate will be $17.50 an hour. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette, Part 1, for Thursday, January 23rd, 2020. Please stay tuned for Part 2.